You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together. Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. I think this is Coach's Corner number 8. We're going to talk about the deadlift. We already did this once before, but Zach's face broke the internet. So we're going to have Ryan start with somebody who comes into what he sees as maybe the biggest hurdle to their deadlift, and then how he goes about like correcting it. So go ahead, Ryan.
I guess like on day one, I'm probably not going to make a change of if they're conventional or sumo. I want to have them come in and pull how they normally do and take a look at it. I think the biggest problem, other than just getting tight enough, and I think people think when they brace that they're tight enough, but it's like you can get tighter, is keeping the bar close to their body. So both in conventional and sumo. So we do a lot of like accessory exercises to try to work on that. And then just, focusing on keeping the lats tight, keeping the bar close to their body. Cause in conventional, when the bar gets away from you, if it's not that heavy, you might be able to muscle it up and you might get away with it. It's not gonna feel great in your lower back, but at least you can kind of get away with it. In sumo, if that bar gets away from you, you're probably done before you even get started. And that's, I think, where a lot of people will miss that lift. They start in a really good position. The bar's right there. It's lined up really low over the middle of their foot. They lock in. And then the moment the bar breaks, you can see the bar shift forward like an inch. And I think that's where a big problem is. So we try to work on that.
How do you work on that? Like, what are some of the accessories you use to work on that? Cause that happens to me.
Right. I mean, I try to use the cue, we say keep the bar close, but we try to use the cue of like either like protect your armpits. Like imagine like I'm going to go like stand behind you and tickle your armpit and you kind of lock your arms down to your ribs at that point. So your lats are a little bit tighter trying to imagine like you're squeezing the juice out of an orange, in your armpit. Those two cues work pretty well. Exercise wise, we'll do straight arm pull downs, but we'll do them, from a position of like a hinge. So we'll kind of get you into your deadlift position, hinge back, and then straight arm, do a straight arm lat pull down to your thighs. So it's like mimicking that like mid range position of the deadlift. And then just thinking, because one of my lifters, Marie, is sitting 5 feet away from me right now. What she did earlier today, because she has the same issue of keeping the bar tight, is she did front banded RDLs. So, going through a normal RDL motion, but there was two mini red bands pulling the bar away from her from the front. So she has to lock the bar in with her lats tight to her body, or it's just going to rip it out of her hands, basically. That's a newer one that we've been doing more just because I have the Mike Bardos PR platform, which just is really easy to set up for it. So that one works really well. And then just, work, just maintaining that lat tension. I think, like I said, a lot of people think they're tight enough and they could get tighter. And if they get tighter, they'll probably hold that position better anyway. So I think that's the most important one. I think a lot of people, depending on the lifts, little things are like where they start. I think a lot of people in sumo start too low because they're thinking they have to squat the weights and they still have to start a little bit higher. And the same thing in conventional, they start too low because they want to use their legs more. I want them to start a little bit higher so it's more of a true hip hinge. But I'll kind of look at it based on the person too, because one of our lifters here, Kate, we tried the true hip hinge and it just kind of ruined her deadlift and went back to more of, getting low to the ground and more of a squat to her deadlift. And she's deadlifting really well again. So I think it depends on the person. A lot on this one thing.
When you do the banded RDLs.
Yep.
So normally, like when I see the bar come away from somebody, 99% of the time, it seems to be that underhand. So do you have them do that mixed grip when you do that accessory, or do you have them double overhand?
No, right now we're just focusing on the double overhand, just kind of working on that tension. And I think period, instead of worrying about like that specific underhand thing. But you're right. I mean, like one of our guys there and I went relatively heavy, Ryan hit like 97% of his best deadlift. And, the 97% looked pretty good. So I think he actually went for a small PR and I think the strength was there. The problem was his underhand definitely pulled out away from his body. And you could see the bar like actually windmill on him, and that's where he lost the lift. So I think right now we're just focusing on the double overhand forward just to work on that. But I think in the long term, especially as we get closer to meets, we'll try to work on that underhand a little bit more.
Yeah, like I know for me, like when I'm trying to pull off the floor, it's definitely my underhand side that comes away. This is sumo. This is not as big of a problem with me conventional. And I don't know if it's just a matter of me not being like patient enough off the floor, but like I'm trying to pull that bar in, but for some reason it's still like still gets away from me. So
I just think in that position, the underhand is a lot hard. It just puts your arm in a position that's harder to lock your lat in. I think it feels more natural to lock your lat in with the overhand grip. So when your underhand grip, it's just easier for it to kind of float away from you. And it's harder to really pull that in because it's kind of reverse of what you're doing. You're trying to, you know, you're pulling your hand back instead of like pulling into it. So I think that's why that hand is usually the issue. I know a lot of people say go to hook grip. Hook grip works for some people. They like it a lot. It doesn't work for everyone. So my thought is more like we need to fix that issue because it's not like it's the grip is not the issue. It's the staying tight and locking the lats in and keeping the bar closed. That's the issue.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not pulling hook grip either. Fuck that.
That sucks.
I'll use my lower back all day long before I'm pulling hook grip. Zach, let's see how the audio is this time around here. And, let's go back to you.
Maybe I should change my answer. No, I won't change it. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Sounds a lot better this time.
Better.
Okay. Well, I guess my face broke the internet. I'd say the number one challenge that I face is my pretty firmly held belief that the first thing that I do to make a deadlifter better when they come to me is I make them proficient or more proficient at their opposite stance. So teaching a sumo puller how to pull conventional better and the vice versa being true. That's definitely probably the number one challenge that I face as a coach with a new lifter. But I did have something actually to add for fixing the bar floating away. We actually have been doing this with Giovanna Ortega in Texas. Gio's a great puller, got a fantastic pull. With her, what we've done is similar to Ryan, we'll do the front banded pulls, but we actually do the comp stance pull. And I'll use a mini band, a single mini band in the very center of the bar, and I anchor it with a heavy dumbbell in the front of the platform. So I try to be I want a minimal anterior pulling vector for her to counteract. And I usually won't do that with deficits, and I will do that with the comp stance as well as the non-competition stance. But that seems to be paying off big dividends for us.
So when you get a new person, if they pull sumo, in that first block, you would immediately make them pull conventional?
Yes, and I actually make it, I actually usually will frustrate them because what I do is I give them a ridiculously light weight, and then we just focus on technique, and that's on their day one. That's on their day one. And they don't want to pull, they want to pull in their comp stance, and they don't want to pull light, they want to pull heavy. So I do the opposite. I give them their non-competition stance and I give it to them ridiculously light. And then we start working on whatever it is in that non-competition stance, the opposite stance that they are not good at. Inevitably, at least in every case that I've dealt with so far, that seems to be whatever the reason, whatever that weak point is, seems to unlock whatever it is that is causing them to struggle in their competition stance. So that, in my opinion, has been a big payoff. So yes, to answer your question, day one, right off the bat, in the first day of the first block, you know, they're going to pull in their opposite stance after they squat.
So how many days a week do you deadlift, Zach?
Generally two.
Two. So on the other day, would they be doing their normal like sumo pulls, or would both days be conventional?
Depends on the level of how much of a veteran they are. So I've got two world champions that IPF world champions that that I am working with now. And in one of the cases, if their mechanics are solid, then I let them right off the bat begin pulling in their comp stance. But if their comp stance pull is sloppy and just generally not strong or needs work in a certain area, then I will actually not let them pull in their comp stance, and I will have them pulling in their opposite stance in the first block
right away. I like it. I do more like you, Zach. I'll look at somebody's deadlift, and you know, if somebody's pulling conventional, the hips are rising up, we're definitely going to pull sumo. You know, if they have that same issue, so if they're pulling sumo and they're, you know, that medium stance sumo and they have a similar issue, they're just not loading the bar into their legs and stuff, I'll immediately put them in a position that just forces them to do that. So we'd go wider to start, but I'm definitely moving those feet in that first block just to kind of like see what it looks like too. And typically if somebody's just starting with me, we're only deadlifting one day to start. And then as things go on, we'll deadlift a second day. And sometimes like, I don't know, I just kind of want to see what the different foot positions look like. So, you know, trying to think of an example, but like I had, so, most of my lifters, just cause they've been with me for a while, since we started doing that. But so after like regionals, I had this one lifter, like hips would rise, her back was really strong. Missed her third attempt. It wasn't that much. She's a newer lifter. I want to say it was like 275. We went immediately afterwards. I was like, you know what? It's actually from like most of our talks too. Like, you know, sumo building up the legs for the deadlift has a carryover to the conventional. I was like, let's just kind of see how this works. So we did sumo deadlifts for 4 weeks, kind of saw how that was breaking down, added in another little variation to that sumo deadlift. 8 weeks later, she pulled her opener for a set of five. And it, you know, she's still a beginner, so we're going to see some progress, of course. But in a 2 month period to take what was 90% ish before for relatively, you know, if I had to put an RPE on it, maybe like an eight for a set of five, that was pretty, kind of sold me on that aspect of it. So now literally every single person does it. And we tend to do it just like right after a meet, but building up, I think, all foot positions, not even just sumo and conventional, but sumo, that medium stance sumo, that wider stance sumo. It definitely like yields much more continual progress in the deadlift than what I was doing before, where you guys remember this is, you know, 6 months ago, even we didn't move our feet at all in the deadlift. However you compete is where you kept your feet, and we would add in the variations from those points on. But it never really, I think, allowed a lot of the lifters to attack the weaknesses within their deadlift with enough weight. So I think like you're talking, Zach, how you have somebody, if they pull sumo and you have them pull conventional, they get beginner gains on that. And pretty quickly, they're starting to pull some decent weight conventional with good technique. And then when that kind of progress stalls or seems to fall back and you bring that sumo deadlift back in, you get like another wave of increases. And like I've seen this with my lifters across the board. Like this isn't even just like a couple of them it works, a couple of them it doesn't. I think in part it comes down to, you know, it's letting them like strengthening those different angles, hits different muscle groups, and just makes them overall, like for that one lifter at regionals, it's allowing her hips to catch up with her back and her leg strength to catch up with her back. And you guys have always moved feet around quite frequently, right, Ryan, with the deadlifts?
Yeah. I mean, we every one of my sumo pullers pulls conventional. Especially like in the off season, we do a lot of conventional pulling, similar to like what Zach said. We do one, competition, style deadlift a week. And then the other day we do some kind of a supplemental exercise for the deadlift. For sumo pullers in the off season, it's, deadlifts to the knees, it's, block pulls, it's full conventional, it's, pause conventional, but it's all conventional stuff for, you know, 12-ish weeks, and really just trying to build up a lot of back strength there. I've seen that when the conventional carries over really well to the sumo pullers, I think it allows them to have a much much more back strength and then maintain their positioning better in their sumo pull. Our conventional pullers will do less sumo than our sumo will do conventional. Generally, we'll pull from blocks if we do, depending on the person. Some people will go full range. I think that helps a lot, gives their lower back a little bit of a rest from all the other stuff, and it builds up their leg strength. So I think that definitely helps. The way I look at it is, like, I want to see your opposite stance within about 10% of your best stance. So, you know, it's, I've got a couple guys like Aaron. Aaron's pulled 620 conventional and 600 sumo. The nice thing there is, like, he had a small back tweak a few years ago. We were able to switch over to sumo, and it didn't really affect his training at all or prep for meets. But if you see someone that's got a big discrepancy, I think that's like that low hanging fruit. Like, if they're pulling, you know, 100 pounds more conventional than they are sumo, then if we bring that sumo up, it's going to have some carryover to the conventional, like either their, like I said, their leg strength or their hip strength or their lockout or vice versa with their back strength if you're doing conventional. But I also think just in, like what you said, Kevin, where for a while you guys just did, you know, you did your comp stance all the time. How do you know if you haven't tried the other one, if the other one's your better stance, maybe? Yeah. Eva's our best example there. Eva, like 5 years ago, I think, was a solely conventional puller. She pulled 315 as a, like, a true max in the gym one day. And, you know, had some windmill to it. It wasn't a great lift, but she got the 315 and she was happy to be like in a three plate club. And a couple weeks later we tried sumo and she absolutely smoked 365, like never had done sumo in her life. And I was like, huh, I guess we're going to pull sumo from now on. And what if we didn't try it? We wouldn't have known. Now, some people on the other hand have tried it and we just did like a whole block. One of our other girls, Jackie, wanted to try sumo. And I said to her, Mike, I don't think this is ever going to be your lift. She's a better conventional puller, but I think the sumo is helping her main. She's getting into a better position with it. I think her conventional is getting to be a better position and her conventional looks better. So I think, like, at the worst, you just have to try it, see. And then, like I said, if there's a weakness there, we got to bring that weakness up.
You made a really good point. And like when I have somebody brand new that I haven't seen lift before, I literally with all their lifts now. So this is probably the most different, like the biggest change I've made to my programming is when I get a brand new person, I'm changing the bar placement, the foot placement, literally on all the grip width on all three lifts, like just to see and let them kind of fuck around with different angles, different foot positions, different grips. And it just kind of helps me like see that the lifter, like in their total, like all their strengths and all their weaknesses, and allows me to kind of pluck things that I either want to run with. Like sometimes things look a lot better. Like you said, like, you know, somebody pulling conventional, all of a sudden their sumo deadlift is, they're able to lift way more. Well, let's run with this for a while. And sometimes you find something that's really weak and it's like, well, let's build this one up for a while. And it kind of helps like the future weeks kind of plan themselves out. And back in the, like when I was doing the same foot position all the time and trying to work on technique, I was of the belief that everything had to be specific. The more specific that it was to the actual competition lift, the more carryover that we would actually see into improvements in technique. But the crazy thing, like, it's not even just off the floor. I had another one who was leaning back too hard once that bar got to the knees conventional, and like the soft lockout was there all the time. The sumo forces you to lock your knees and keep them locked. It reinforces that. If you lean back, you're going to fall over. So we literally, I gave her sumo deadlifts just to see how it would work. 2 months later, the first time she pulls conventional, the best looking conventional deadlift she's done of her life. Like there's a lot of transference from the two. And I think like for me personally, sumo is easier for me to load that weight into my hips and legs. So even though I don't pull as much sumo, like at my meet, whenever the hell it was, a few weeks ago, by my deadlift opener conventional, I'd be shaking a little bit, even though it would move fast and wouldn't be a problem. I had zero shaking on my third attempt at my meet a couple weeks ago pulling sumo, and it's just because I'm able to load it into my legs more and keep a lot of the load off of my back. And I think building that up over time, I'll obviously have a much larger ceiling for my deadlift, I think, pulling sumo. But of course, keeping all of them in, because, you know, not training my sumo ever, obviously those 3 years of pulling conventional made my sumo stronger. Because there's no way 3 years ago I was pulling the same weight sumo that I pulled 2 weeks ago. So they do kind of feed into each other, and it's something that shattered my beliefs, I guess, a little bit on the way that like technique and all that stuff seems to work. So Zach, when you take on people in the beginning and you bless you, and you switch the stance on the deadlift, do you see the same thing? Like when you bring that comp deadlift back in, you see improvements in technique without necessarily training that comp stance very often?
I can't think of a single time, at least in the last 10 years, when I haven't. And that goes both ways. I know it's not popular to believe that having your conventional pullers pull sumo transfers over, but I was sitting here listening to you guys as I was driving home, and I was listening and I thought, well, I mean, that's fine. I mean, I don't mind being the one with the unpopular opinion. We're just going to keep doing it and keep getting better. So it doesn't have to be a popular opinion, because it definitely has worked. Having my conventional pullers pull sumo has had so many more benefits and paid off so many dividends in response to not only just conventional deadlift technique, it actually transfers quite well to the squat. If you have a conventional puller that squats well, I believe that teaching them how to sumo deadlift, in addition to doing what Ryan said about making their conventional deadlift more proficient, and making them stronger off the floor. In addition to that, I think it makes them better squatters. I truly believe that it makes them better squatter. And if you can get that, you know, that difference, like Ryan said, with 10%, it's huge. And I think everyone's technique can get better. Many times, and this is again not a popular opinion, but many times IPF world champions don't have the best technique. Sometimes they do, but many times they don't. They're just strong through genetics or hard work. Let's be politically correct here, because it's not popular to be politically incorrect. So yeah, let's be politically correct and say it's not always genetics. Sometimes it is hard work, but a lot of times they don't have perfect technique. So everyone's technique can get better, and I think that improving your weaknesses in target muscle groups over multiple angles, multiple stances, pays off and largely not just in your competition stance, but I know we're talking about deadlifts today, but it pays off as well. I think, just as an extreme example, if you have a sumo puller that you teach to be extremely, extremely proficient in their conventional deadlift, I think that pays off in the bench. I really do. Because if you get their upper back supremely stronger, like we talked about in the past couple of podcasts, an upper back strength improvement increases scapular stability, increases rotator cuff, tension and strength. It increases posture, resting posture, active posture. It increases scapular mobility. And all of that creates a great platform for the bench. So, the long answer to your question is every single time.
I think, you know, I know we're talking about the deadlift, but all three lifts kind of feed each other, right? So the squat and the deadlift work the same muscles. But like for me, I have the same technical breakdown in all three lifts. My upper back gets, I don't keep it tight. Like coming up from the squat, the start of the deadlift, and off the bench, like that's the area I need to focus on personally in all three. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it just happens on all three of them. And like usually, like if somebody, you know, if their hips are rising before the bar breaks the floor, they tend to have the same problem on the squat. Like they end up getting pitched forward coming out of the hole. And like, you know, and this is why I actually like in the beginning with somebody just changing angles quite a bit, because it can really like highlight those weaknesses and highlight those strengths. And, you know, I make sure that there's enough. So in that first block, we'll squat 3 days, we'll deadlift once, and bench 2 to 3 days, depending on what they were doing before. And I'll make sure that I keep enough volume in there of the angles that they're strong at to actually maintain their strength levels there. And then the rest of it will just fill with the stuff that they really struggle with. So if that leg strength is lacking, there's going to be a lot of wide stance squats. There's going to be wider stance deadlifts, is, you know, and like, I think it's not just that one deadlift, the one wider stance deadlift that's fixing that technique issue. It's the deadlift plus focusing on that with, you know, the three squat days, or whatever. Like, I think you can't just pull out deadlift training and not take into consideration what you're doing with the squat, at the same time. Cause I think, like, if I have a sumo puller that's pulling conventional, we're sure as hell doing some high bar wide stance squats to hit the same muscle groups so that they're comp deadlifts, like, they're still kind of getting a training effect with that comp deadlift at the time. So I don't think it's just necessarily the conventional. It's definitely the change of pace. And if they don't keep that back tight with the high bar wide stance squat, they're going to each hit. So it does carry over to that. I think that sumo deadlift too. Do you agree, Ryan?
Yeah. I mean, I always say that I think almost everyone's biggest weakness when they come in is, if they've been training for a while, is their upper back strength. Like, so like you said, that being an issue, and that's going to affect all three lifts immensely. So we hammer the crap out of upper back. And we do back work every day. It might only be one exercise, but we do back work every day. And, you know, sumo pullers, if you think about, like, you know, they're not getting that same kind of back work as the conventional puller, but if they can't maintain that thoracic extension, then they round over. It's crazy. I think when you see, like, a sumo puller that gets it to, like, their knees and then just can't finish because they're in a bad position. So I said, like, doing conventional for that, I think, is a perfect fix. So yeah, they definitely carry over. And like Zach said, I've never even, like, thought of it like this, but, like, you know, sumo going towards squat, you know, it's more of a squat pattern than a conventional is. And you're right. It's a like a nice way to train the squat without having to load the squat up again too. So I think they like I said, they all definitely have a carryover to each other. They all affect each other. So we just have to find the right fix.
And I think it gives you a good insight as a coach. So, like, you know, I mentioned, like, the hips rising up and, like, being the same on both lifts. But sometimes, like, I have a newer lifter now who their sumo deadlift, they're very strong with it and patient off the floor. Like, you don't see the hips rising. You don't see the knees coming in. But on the squat, you see the knees coming in hard, the hips popping up and chest falling forward. And, like, I, you know, the difference there is just, like, they have this, like, controlled aggression like they should have on that sumo deadlift, but they're sacrificing that control in the squat. So that tells me that they have that leg and hip strength to stay upright on a squat that is far less than their deadlift. It's just, it's a matter of teaching them that control and how to use it and to put them in a position that kind of forces them to do that. Where, you know, if that's happening on both lifts, the accessory work is going to be more targeted to, like, hips and legs almost every single day in that case, but maybe not the case with that lifter. So I think as a coach, it gives you just a lot more information to kind of go on. And I want to get back to that technique thing that you were mentioning, Zach, about, like, you know, how a lot of world champions don't show, like, great technique. And I think this is where, like, the real challenge for coaching comes in, right? Is we can't just lift 70% weights all of the time and then throw 90%+ on the platform and expect to see perfect technique. Like, it just, once you load it up, it gets very different, whether it's psychological, physical, both. So when you throw in the conventional in the beginning, will you build that up to, like, be able to load it at relative intensities? Like, for them, that would be like an 8 or a 9, like something that's really heavy for them with that conventional deadlift. Or you just run with it and keep it light the whole time and then bring back the comp lift for the heavier stuff.
If we're see, it all is so athlete dependent. I know that a lot of people that listen to the podcast are budding coaches, powerlifting coaches, and I get email from someone a while back said that they really, you know, enjoy it and they like learning from it and stuff. So a lot of this stuff is so experience dependent. It's form dependent. It's, you know, their proficiency or their veteran level or, you know, how elite they are, because maybe we're not looking for, you know, short-term gains. We're looking at the long road. Or, you know, a good example, I guess, would be Brittany, Robbie, or Brittany Raby, who is a student at Iowa. Brittany has been powerlifting longer than most of the open lifters. She's now in probably her eighth year of powerlifting, and she's just a sophomore or junior in college. She has phenomenal technique, but she really never trained. She's a sumo lifter, and she never really trained very hard her conventional deadlift. So with her, we had such a substantially long period of time. We had like 27 weeks in between her competitions. So what I did with her was we kept on her day one, we kept her opposite stance or conventional pull in for 18 weeks, probably. It was between 12, no, it was more than 12. So I'd say between 15 and 18 weeks. And then we slowly, gradually built that up over time. You know, I started with like light percentages for sets of eight to just see technique. And I wanted the biomechanical pattern to be more ingrained. I wanted to be more deep brain. So we did a lot. We did some eights at relatively light intensity to kind of develop it and make sure that it was autonomic, so she didn't have to think so much. And believe me, that was stressful. Not because Brittany's not coachable; she's extremely coachable. She's does absolutely everything I ask her to do. She's literally a coach's dream, largely due to her high school coach, who was a phenomenal, great coach himself, Steve Zahn, who did a great job with her in high school. But it took a lot of time and practice because, okay, no, bring your feet 5 degrees in. No, not 5 inches, 5 degrees. And so we would go back and forth on video. She's in Wisconsin and I'm in Florida. We messed around with grip. We messed around with switching her grip of overhand, underhand. We messed around with bringing her hands in and out. And then, you know, in this particular example, if you turn a lifter's feet out 5 degrees, well, that changes the angle of their knees as their knees bend to pull conventional. Well, then we had to adjust her grip because now her knees were getting in the way of her elbows because her feet were externally rotated, and that changed the whole entire bar path. So it went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And so finally, once we got the movement pattern down autonomically, more deep brain, then over the course of like that 15 to 18 weeks, we slowly built her up from sixes to fives to fours. And we've pretty much got her sumo now to, I think it's closer than maybe, it might be 8% of her sumo pull. And then after that point, then we dropped the opposite stance pull off the day one and just really concentrated on hammering it on day two. So, or our day three, rather. Our day three is where we really worked our comp stance. And someone like Brittany, who's extremely coachable and is actually a technician in the way she handles herself, she prides herself on consistency on the platform. I don't ever have to worry about her form breaking down on the platform. And usually it's a cue change of like where her tightness is and where she should be feeling it. I can do that. But for somebody who is maybe less experienced, maybe not as proficient at providing good tactile feedback after the fact or in between sets or maintaining constant consistency with her motor patterns, someone like that, I probably would use more relatively light intensity to slowly build that up over time to maybe an RPE 7, maybe an 8, but probably closer to like a 7. And then as the cycles progress over time and they really achieve that maturity as far as their lifting and the way that they move and their mechanics become more ingrained and more perfect over a longer period of time, then I would probably integrate a higher intensity to try and get to that point where they're, like Ryan was saying, more closely matched with their comp stance.
What about you, Ryan? You guys lift heavier. You have a similar approach to that.
So the biggest difference is like we on our comp day, so our day three which is our deadlift day, we only pull singles. And the way I kind of program is everything's like in a 3 week wave. So one of the weeks is moderately heavy, and then they have the choice to work up a little bit heavier depending on how it looks. So, you know, way out from a meet, moderately heavy might be six or seven singles at like 80%. But if it looks good and it feels good, we can work up a little bit. And some days if it's there, it might actually be a kind of a PR day, or some days it might be 90% or 95%. The other two deadlift days in that 3 week block are not going to be workup days. Those are going to be more just consistent with the weight. One day is going to be just getting in a bunch of reps at like, 75%. Early in the program. As we get late in the program, it'll be probably closer to 80-85%. Just getting some work in.
What are the rep schemes you're using with those?
All singles. So on our comp day, we only pull singles. So on like the volume day, we might be looking at, depending on how it is, depending on who we're talking about, like upwards of 15 to 20 singles. I know when people first see there, they hear that, they're like, you're out of your damn mind. But like, I'm talking 20 singles at like 70%, or 15 singles at 75%. Like, that wouldn't be any different than you guys riding like a 3x5.
Right.
It's the same idea. All I'm making them do is get away from the bar, reset, come back, do it again. And on some of those days, I'm only talking about a 15-second rest in between if it's light enough. You know, some days it might be more like a minute, depending on what they're doing.
For all 20?
Yeah. I mean, like, if it's 70%, I'll usually tell them, like, they should finish all 20 in 10 minutes or less. Because it's, like I said, 70%. You you rip the first single, you step back, take a couple deep breaths, step back up, boom, do it again. They usually tell me by rep 12, they want to kill me. And like, weirdly, by rep 20, they're like, well, that wasn't that bad. It was fine. The third day in that cycle is usually more of like we've talked about, like the heavier speed day, where I want them to really, to crush the rep. I wanted them to put 100% force into a 65% deadlift, and absolutely just destroy it. And depending on the person, we might do it from a small deficit. So we might have them stand on anywhere from like a half inch to a 2 inch block. Or depending on where we are in the program, we might add chains, we might add bands. We'll use all that. But like I said, that's more of a true speed day. Our squat day, which is when we do our deadlift supplemental work, that's where we'll get our reps in. So like I said before, like if you're a sumo puller, you're doing conventional, maybe that day it's going to be 3x5 conventional. Or if you're, maybe you're doing 3x8 RDL or something like that, but that's where we're getting our reps in on everything. But on our main day, it's just singles. I know a lot of people ask me that. We've gone back and forth on that. I remember like probably 10 years ago, I read that from Dave Tate and I was like, oh, that's a good idea. Did it. Got away from it, went back to reps, went back to singles, went back to reps, talked to Matt Gary about how they do singles, reread the Dave Tate article, kind of like kept going back and forth in my head. And probably about 3 or maybe 4 years ago, we went back to singles again. And I've stayed with singles ever since.
I think there's certain people who you watch deadlift and it's probably more than 50%. Like that first rep, there is almost like this hesitation to it. Like they're feeling out the weight, but then the second and third rep look great.
Right.
And like that kind of would force them to get out of that like mentality. And those short rests,
they suck.
Yeah. I mean, my heart would want to fucking explode, but having them step away and then get right back in there, you're kind of getting that same effect of that third rep being fucking hard, if that's what you're looking for, whatever,
right.
But you're getting them to step away and teach them to pull that first rep like they were that second and third rep. And right. I like that idea.
I just think, like I said before, like I think a lot of people don't get as tight as they could be. And I think on rep work, and not all rep work, it depends on the person, but I think on rep work, a lot of times it's easier to start to get loose. So I like having them, like I said, even if it's only 15 seconds, step away, take a few deep breaths, come back up, get set, lock in, pull again. For me, it's getting them to get in their starting position and lock in as tight as they can be every time, where I don't think when they're doing rep work, they're consciously thinking about that. But like when they walk back up to the bar, it's like, oh, I have to get set again because it's a new set. And like, it might have only been 15 seconds, but it's still a new set and they're setting up again. So I like doing that. I had someone ask me why we don't do that with the, like, well, if you're going to do singles or deadlift, why not do singles or squat and bench? And I always say, well, there's no eccentric, and that's why we use that. It's a little bit different, but we're still using it. Like I said, we're still using our rep work on the other day. So it's not like we're never doing volume of deadlift stuff. It's just not with our comp pulls.
There's been times too where like we might overshoot a heavy triple or a heavy double or something, and instead like I'll call an audible and just be like, keep that heavy weight and let's just take no more than 90 seconds rest in between reps, and they'll be able to get like 5-6 reps with pretty heavy fucking weight that doesn't really beat them up too much, and you're getting some like really quality heavier work in there at the same time. So like I could see how like focusing on the singles, the benefit of it for a number of reasons. Like you get more heavier sets, you get better technique, you take out the hesitation on the first rep.
Yeah, I think of it almost like with like cluster sets, like for squat or bench, where like, you know, if you do, you can do like three clusters with a, you know, three clusters of two reps with like your four rep max. So you're getting six reps in, but you're taking, you know, 10, 15 seconds in between each little mini double. It just allows us, I think, to get more work in. I don't think it beats us up as much. I think rep work on the deadlift, especially in conventional, is just, those are the day. That's like the next day when your back is just trashed. And I'm not even just talking about your low back. I'm talking mid back, upper back and everything. You're just like, oh, like just sitting down hurts. I think the singles mitigates that a little bit. My lifters might tell you otherwise, but I think it's just like I said, it's a way to get a little bit more work in and hopefully not beat them up as much.
I think like the technique thing, especially, you know, to get it to transfer over to the heavier weight, like that's a challenge, right? And like the way I was doing it before, where I was dropping the weight and I would add a variation that obviously makes that weight a little bit harder, but like you just, 80% might look great, but like as you get into those heavier weights, it's still not like really looking great. And I think the problem with it is you just, the load has to be there. Like that intensity has to be there in order for it to transfer over. And there are times where I think maybe taking less weight is an answer, but like lately that's not been my like rationale behind things. So instead of dropping the weight, I'll find ways that I can keep that. Like I still want that RPE to be near like a 9 on 1 to 2 sets at least. So I'll put them in positions where, you know, maybe their conventional deadlift is far less than their sumo, so you have to drop weight, but we're working up to something fucking heavy. And like, I've stopped looking at that like variability that happens in their like movement patterns as being negative. And instead it's more just them trying to figure it out. So like, I'll give them a little bit of feedback, but then we'll alter their positions a little bit. So if their deadlift from the floor just looks absolutely fucking atrocious, if it's conventional, we'll maybe put it up on blocks or maybe add a pause mid shin to get them in a better position off the ground. Like I'll put some type of changes within the actual exercise itself, but we're always going to do it fucking heavy. Whether that's RPE, absolute load on the bar, like, and I have found that this, like just letting them play with something for a few weeks and me not being so like anal about what it looks like. And instead just letting them lift heavy, in the positions that punish that poor behavior. And then 4 weeks later, 5 weeks later, 6 weeks later, just assess what it looks like and make other changes if we need to. Like all of a sudden there'll be this period of time where, you know, maybe it's that 4, 5, 6 week period where all of a sudden they figure it out. And then you're starting to see that consistency in reps. They're starting to load it more. And then you literally, with opposite stance deadlifts that are so far behind, all of a sudden you're adding 30, 40, 50 pounds to that lift in a very short amount of time. And we'll just keep riding that wave until you start to see that progress fall off. And then from there, I bring in something else or bring back the comp lift, depending on where they're at. But I found that like for the technique stuff, it's not me not necessarily being more anal or being less anal with it. It's just me attacking it with heavier weights in different positions and kind of just like setting them on the path to kind of figure it out so that they get better. Like somebody's knees caving in on a squat, we're going to just keep widening it up until you figure it out. And it's going to be heavy every single time that we do that. And it might be like, you know, I have this one kid in Hungary,
had just started with me maybe 3 or 4 months ago. Always said his hips hurt pulling sumo. So we kept conventional in just off blocks, just to be able to load it up a little bit to keep the back, threw in some box squats to train that same angle too. But his sumo stance to start is like, I mean, his feet are probably 3 feet apart. Like, it is a very narrow sumo stance. And either last week or this week, we were able to widen it a couple of inches. And like, you're starting, like, because it's so far behind, you get these beginner gains. It's starting to feel a little bit better. So, you know, a couple of weeks from now, we'll widen it again. Then we'll widen it again. Kind of like what you do, Zach, when you leave it in there for a prolonged period of time. And we'll just keep every time. Like, obviously the absolute load's different, but we're going to work up to something heavy, see what it looks like, make the adjustments to fix those technique things that are happening under those conditions, widen it up, see what it looks like, do the same thing. And like, we'll just keep riding that wave until he stops seeing progress. And then we'll switch things up again. And I found that like making sure that those heavy sets being in there have just worked a lot better for the technique. You don't necessarily have to take that step back that I always thought was necessary to fix technique. They're at least being able to maintain or even improve their strength a little bit while they go through the process of getting better. Like, I'm not as worried about bad reps, I guess, as I used to be. I just see it as my job to put them in a position that just punishes those bad reps, which I guess is a little bit different than what I was doing before, but it seems to be working pretty well. Do you guys find that your lifters, and we'll start with you, Zach, with the deadlift, that you, across the board, it just seems to be harder to recover from, or do you feel that there's a huge individual difference with this aspect of it?
I would say it's a bell curve. So I'd say the majority of people on our team require a good amount of time to recover neurologically. I think all three of us agree that the greatest detriment or the amount of fatigue that comes from deadlifting is neurological. There's physiological, certainly. I mean, as much as every other lift, I would say, but more so than the other two, the deadlift requires more neurological recovery. So bell curve, I'd say the answer, most of the majority of our lifters, they need that time. I got to have at least 2 days between our deadlift days. I don't want it to be a Monday, Wednesday, and I don't want it to be a Monday, Tuesday. So at least 2 days in between. There are a couple of lifters that I'd say that are on our squad that can do it, but they're statistical outliers. They also have the advantage of youth on their side. As in both of these cases, I'm sure we have some lifters that are overzealous and are more sure of themselves and their own individual invincibility than we think they are. But the overall effect is short-lived, certainly in my experience. So I would say that there are a couple that can that require less recovery. But by and large, I'd say everybody pretty much follows that bell curve of a minimum of 2 days. I don't know. What about you guys?
Go ahead, Ryan.
You guys said, you said before, and I think it probably just needs to be stated again. It's like, it so much depends on the lifter. You know, like, I was talking about this. I have a couple of interns who work at the gym, and we were talking about, like, you have to coach the lifter, not the lift. Yes, there's things about the lift we want to see, but the lifter makes everything different. I know we've said that a few times here, but that's really important to say again. I have a few lifters, someone like Mags. There's times where I have her deadlift 3 times a week. Mags has pulled 435 at 137 pounds. So she's got one of the higher deadlifts in the 63 kilo class. And she's a narrow stance sumo puller, but she can pull. She's, like I said, we've had 8-10 week blocks where she's pulled 3 times a week, but only squatted twice a week. It seems like squat beats her up a little bit more. I think I agree with Zach. Muscular wise, I think the recovery is probably longer for squats than it is for deadlift, especially again, because we do the singles. I think the muscular action isn't as bad. the neurological, I would agree with once you get over a certain weight. You know, when we're pulling 70% for singles, I mean, we could probably do that every day. Not that we're going to. Again, I think the craziest we've done is just mags at 3 days a week. But it's someone like Matt Piscatelli, who Matt last year at collegiates pulled, I think 694 was the collegiate national record for the 93 kilo raw class. And when Matt goes heavy in a workout, and I'll be honest, I think it's hilarious. I hope he listens to this so we can feel bad about it. If you see him go heavy in a day, within like 10 minutes of that last heavy pull, he's starting to fall asleep. So he lives like about an hour from the gym. He probably can't go heavy here anymore on deadlifts because he won't be able to drive home. He's that shot that fast. So he pulled 716 for a double off the block, off a 2-inch block recently, and literally had to stop his workout and do all the accessory work the next day because he was destroyed.
Do you find when he gets that heavy that like he's one of those like really like fires himself up for those big pulls type of lifter? He seems like he would be from.
He's getting better about that. Him and I talked about that. He's one of those people that like when you see him lift, it looks like all the rage in the world is on his face.
Yeah, exactly.
And we've been doing, and it's funny because like I've said in these that I'm generally not a fan of tempo work, but we've been doing some tempo deadlifts with him, and he's gotten better about not trying to just smoke it right off the floor. And he's been more controlled, and his deadlift looks a lot cleaner, a lot smoother than it used to. So he's not amping himself up as much for it as he used to. But it still has that effect afterwards. Like, so when he gets over like 650, which I mean, like, that's a very heavy lift for him. We're talking 93% plus. He starts to really have a, like, just within a very short time frame, he's done. Like, he just needs to call it for the day and we'll come back and we'll fight another day tomorrow. But we have other lifters that pull, you know, 95% every few weeks and like, you know, and they're fine. So I think it's very dependent on the lifter, which makes it obviously so difficult too, because you can't just do the same thing and expect it to work. You have to see what's going on. But yeah, I mean, muscular wise, I think we can recover from that faster than we can recover from the squat. So like, I know peaking wise, at least we take our last deadlift a little bit later than we take our squat because we're not going heavy enough to ruin them CNS wise. But I think they recover muscular wise faster from that than they do from, squatting.
So with Matt, how long does he take to recover from? So he takes a, let's say like a really heavy pull, like over 650.
Yep.
How many more days would it take him before he'd be able to kind of repeat that same performance?
I mean, he'll be back in the gym the next day. He'll finish up his accessory work the next day. He usually does that like on a Thursday. So usually by Monday, he's back in squatting and doing some accessory work for deadlift, some supplemental work, like, you know, some other variation of the deadlift. So he can usually get back in pretty well by that point. The following Thursday on his next deadlift day, it usually is trash. And we know that. We know that if he goes up that heavy, we know the next week he is not going to pull well. So we've made some adjustments where, like, his following week, if he goes that heavy, we know that next week we're going to drop the intensity a little bit because it just feels awful. But then by the next week, if I asked him to pull 650 again, I bet you he could. He'd be fine.
So maybe like every other week, he'd be able to handle like a.
Yeah, if we did every week, I would kill him. He would be dead pretty quick. But like I said, I mean, he'll pull 650 this week, and then like the next week, even if we have him go to 550, which is a pretty good drop, it'll feel awful. But then the next week he'll pull. I think like he's got 8 singles at 595 this week. Like that's, and he'll crush it. It'll be fine.
Yeah. I find like, I mean, obviously like, you know, there's huge individual differences with all of this stuff, but like part of me wonders if we can train some of those aspects. Cause like Dave, who I have, used to be like, maybe we could pull heavy like that, like once a month, but he used to be like super like amped up, loud music, get after it. Like, But obviously, since we've been lifting heavier more often and stuff, you kind of get used to it and you just kind of like go about it like it's your job. But the last 4 weeks, his best ever pull leading before this block was 700. And he pulled 675 for a double. Then he pulled 700 for a double. Then he pulled 675 for a triple. Then he pulled 725 for a double yesterday. Like, there's this like crazy amount of linear progress happening on the deadlift with like seemingly almost like X-Men type recovery, because like he's doubled 630 on a squat when his best is, I mean, his best at a meet's like 640 something. So like he's hitting these big numbers on all of these lifts in a much like more frequent pattern than I think we've seen in the past. And like part of it, like he had a tough training block and, you know, everything was feeling fine. And it's just like, let's just keep doing it and see what happens at the other end. And it just seems like at the other end of this is just like, he's almost like adapted to it. And he's just kind of able to like attack those heavier weights more frequently. And I don't know. I don't even know how to explain some of that. And he's not even the only one. Like, I've had a couple lifters like this, just not lifting like that same, those same absolute loads of weight. And I think, and let me ask you a question too about Mag. So I know she's like, you can tell, right? She's very confident on that deadlift. What are her confidence levels like on the squat? Because I wonder if maybe her lack of confidence is what kind of like makes it beat her up a little bit more. Almost right. Like Mac getting super hyped. Like she's like the exact opposite for squats. I wonder if that like maybe hinders her recovery.
Right. Mags, if you're listening, don't hate me. And yeah, I think you're right. I mean, she's a much more natural puller. Her squat is always interesting. She broke the 300 barrier this year at Raw Nats. That was like a big thing. We just wanted to get that number off the board because she'd done it in the gym a few times, but had missed in meets, I think three times. So we just kind of wanted to get that number off the board. And she's one of those, like, just the way she's built, you'll see, like, even when she's like rock bottom squat, it's always like close to depth for her. That's just the way she's built. So I think squat is just, it's not her lift. She doesn't go into it with the same thought process as deadlift. You're probably right there. So like it that might have some carryover to it. I think a lot of it's just, like I said, the way she's built. I think when, you know, like Matt and her are probably both built for deadlifting, so they can deadlift more often, where, you know, someone that's built for squatting, can probably squat all the time. But then their deadlift might beat them up a little bit more. So I think like they can probably, like I could, Matt and I have joked about pulling more often. I think I could probably have him pull three times a week as long as I kept the intensity in check, and I think he'd be fine. But if I had him squat more, he'd probably be dying. And I think Mags is the same way. But the mindset, you're right. I think that's a lot to do with it. Like you said, like getting amped up. Matt's one of those guys. We had a bunch of them that like used to, if they were going heavy, we'd crank the music, hit nose torque. And like, this is, you know, we're talking in the gym and going nuts, trying to get amped up. And now it's more like, okay, let's do this with, like, so 80s, Friday is 80s Friday here at the gym. So we play 80s music the whole day. And I know some people
love it.
I love it. It's a nice end of the week after metal and rap all week, but some people hate it. But like, if you can go pull a heavy deadlift to like Billy Joel, then you can probably go pull it to Slipknot. So we don't need to have Slipknot all the time. Especially cause like you guys know when you go to meets, like, okay, our meets here, like we're probably playing metal, but like when you're in nationals, it's like elevator music a lot of the time.
Right.
So like if you need to amp up that much, then you're in trouble. But yeah, I think that's something that I haven't really thought of with the mindset there, Kevin, is like she probably goes into deadlift more aggressive because she knows it's going to feel better. And it probably feels better afterwards because of that.
Yeah. I mean, I like how you brought up the music too, right? Cause music definitely is like one of those things that affects performance. And if you're always getting amped up to Slipknot in your headphones when you're lifting and at a meet, that's not, hopefully the crowd or like competition itself like brings that out. I'm the, like with music, if I listen to like Slipknot from like the start of my warmups, I'll be napping before I get on the freaking platform. Like I'll have an adrenaline dump from that, like,
right,
heavy music like that. Like when I'm warming up, I'm listening to fucking Adele or something. Like it's gonna be like calm and like, and I think there's a time to bring out like the heavier stuff, so maybe it's just like less exposures to it, like third attempt
like my second squat was heavy as fuck. And like knowing that I had another jump and like I was going to take it, like there was some heavy music going on before then, like almost like dipping into that well at the right times as opposed to either like all the time or something, I think is like helped me control my emotions more during a meet where I won't have those like those ups and downs where you're trying to like, you get a crash after a big lift and you're trying to like run around to scatter to get like back to baseline to bench and then the same thing before deadlift. So like, you know, I like the idea of changing the music.
I also think on meet day though too, like deadlift is the, even for people that maybe aren't deadlifters or maybe they don't like to deadlift as much, I think that's the easiest one to really get amped up for. It's the end of the meet. I think the crowd just naturally gets into it a little bit more. I think outside of the, like some serious lifts, like, you know, runettes when you're seeing Ray squat 1,000 or, you know, or Jen benching 315 like that, you know, it's people are going nuts for that obviously. But like, I think the crowd, the lifters, I think they get more amped up for deadlift anyway.
That's true.
So it's going to have a natural boost on meet day. Where like, I don't think we need to pull as heavy in the gym to have an idea where we are on meet day for deadlift, where for squat and bench, I want to go a little bit heavier to see where we're at. Because I think everyone just gets more amped up for deadlift. Like I said, even if you don't like deadlift, I think it's just easier to get amped up for it. It's hard to get amped up when the weight is on you. Deadlift, you can kind of like go out there and you're getting amped up and then grab and go. And then, you know, that first second you're like, oh shit, this is heavy. But like you amped yourself up better beforehand because you can kind of get worked into it. So I think that has a big carryover. Since we're kind of taking the shift, like talking about music, like we've talked about Sophie Varis a few times. Like, so I know like what Soph does is she's listening to much more calm music. Like she's trying to get her system to just kind of calm down in between lifts. And then I'll kind of go over to her and be like, hey, we're five out. And she's got her headphones on and she'll switch the music to like to something more aggressive to get her system amped up. She'll take the lift, she'll come off and she'll immediately put the headphones back on and bring whatever she was listening to calm herself back down again. I think that's also super helpful, especially on deadlift.
Yeah. I think that's a really good idea. Like,
it's like you said, like
for your emotions.
Yeah. If you're just trying to be aggressive the whole time, like how long can you be aggressive before you got nothing left in the tank?
Right. Exactly. Zach, you got any, closing thoughts on maybe like the mental side of, the training?
Training
or competing, like even just with the deadlift?
I think everyone shouldn't use absolutes. Many people believe that the most nerve-wracking attempt in a meet is the first squat. And I would say that's probably true. It's definitely true, I would say, for most equipped lifters. There's a whole lot of other stuff involved there, but I believe that if a lifter does not walk out on the platform for their first deadlift set up for success, in other words, their warm-ups are correct, they're correctly timed, they are warmed up to the approximate weight that they should be so that it's a nice, easy jump up to their opening attempt. The opening attempt is selected correctly so that it gives them emotional and mental confidence moving forward to the second attempt. If that, I think that is probably at least equally crucial as the opening squat. In fact, statistics show that if you miss your opening squat, you're three times more likely to miss your opening deadlift. That's the, like, it's an old stat, 5-10 years old, but, and maybe it's outdated now, but I think that it is entirely up to the lifter to set themselves up emotionally and mentally. But if they're set up for success when they walk onto the platform and that opening deadlift feels and looks like an opening deadlift should, they're going to be set up for success. So regarding your question mentally, I think that, you know, it is a sign of maturity of the lifter, emotional maturity, when they can walk out into the platform with confidence to attempt a weight that is well within their means, looks and feels like an opening deadlift should feel, and they should approach their training with the same mindset that they can do it, and that the mechanics are autonomic, and that that when something gets heavy, their emotional toughness and their mental toughness forces them to not sacrifice mechanics for making the load move faster. And I think you alluded to that earlier, Kevin. So I think that mental toughness is a huge part of the deadlift. And I think that especially with the first deadlift, if you walk out there and approach it with the wrong mindset or the wrong, like the wrong emotions, whether external or internally motivated, you're going to really ruin your chances of not only having a 3-for-3 day, but putting yourself in a position for a PR or a medal.
Yeah. And I think that mental toughness and training, like, I think it can be trained, and you can, you know, if somebody's RPEs are higher than what I'm witnessing, I'm going to put more weight on the bar. Like, I think you can train mental toughness a little bit in the gym. But I think that's important for like training, even leading up to that meet, not even just on the platform. So let's wrap this up. Let everybody know where they can find you guys on the interwebs, and we'll sign off. We'll start with you, Ryan.
GleasonPerformance.com. Instagram is TeamGPT, and you can email me at Ryan@GleasonPerformance.com.
Zach?
We're Cooper Training Institute on Facebook, Cooper Training Institute on Instagram, and I'm actually hammering the Twitter lately, so we're training at Training Cooper on Twitter, and you can hit us up there.
Follow me, KW Can, our team, Precision Powerlifting Systems, on Instagram, because I'm not using any of their social media database. One's enough. Stay strong, Boston.